We're 1 Samuel chapter 12. Israel has asked for a king. Samuel, brokenhearted before the Lord, is told by the Lord, Samuel, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. This is the way they've been since I brought them out of the land of Egypt. Grant them now this king that they're asking for, but warn them, let them know what they're going to be in for with a human being sitting in the place that I should have in their lives, that Israel should be a theocracy, not a monarchy. And he's going to take your sons and daughters into his army, into his service. He's going to take your land. He's going to take taxes from you to run government. He's going to do all of these things. And Israel says, we don't care. We want a king to deliver us, to give us victory. And those are the things that God had always done for them. And verse 20 in chapter 12 says, and Samuel said unto the people, fear not, even though that they had rebelled in asking for this king. You have done all this wickedness, yet turn not aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. Turn ye not aside, for then should you go after vain things, which cannot profit nor deliver, for they are vain. For the Lord will not forsake his people. What a great consolation. For his great name's sake. Because it hath pleased the Lord to make you his people. And now Samuel shares his own heart. Moreover, as for me, God forbid that I should sin against the Lord in ceasing to pray for you. But I will teach you the good and the right way. Isn't that interesting? Samuel looks at his calling. What a rebuke that is for me, for those of us who know that we need a jump start in our prayer lives and as far as intercession. Samuel says that it would be sin against the Lord if he ceased to pray for God's people. Interesting, the relationship he sees himself in with God's people. You know, the priest was one who went to the Lord on behalf of the people. The prophet is the one who went to the people on behalf of the Lord. You know, the priest is the one who worked at the tabernacle or at the temple and through ceremony and sacrifice offered things before the Lord on behalf of the people, their sin, their transgression, and so forth. Whereas the prophet was the one who stayed in the presence of the Lord and came to the people on behalf of God. And he says, God forbid that I should cease to pray for you, because no doubt that is where Samuel got his marching orders as he was in the presence of the Lord. You know, for you Bible students, Campbell Morgan is probably one of my favorite commentators. Used to save his sermons. He would file them away, and then as he would come back to portions of Scripture, he had things that were there that he was familiar with. And he happened to be looking in the text in Matthew's Gospel about John the Baptist where it says, behold, I send my messenger before thy face. And he said as he looked at that and he pulled out his old sermon to look at something, and other pastors were starting to, of course, use the sermons, I do. And he said the Lord reproved him and said, do you want to be my messenger or do you want to be a priest? And he said the Lord just spoke to him and said, you know, John the Baptist was born to Zechariah. He's a priestly family. And it's easy to be a priest because all of your duties are written out. You offer this sacrifice for this sin. You offer this sacrifice for this free will offering. You offer this sacrifice for this. You offer this sacrifice in the morning. You offer this sacrifice in the evening. You do this at this feast. You do this at that feast. And it's easy to be a priest because everything's scrolled out for you. But how difficult to be the Lord's messenger in the sense that every morning you're waiting for your marching orders. They're not written out in the sense that, of course, God would never have us transgress his word, but to get before him every morning and say, Lord, speak, your servant heareth. And speak to me, Lord, and give me your heart for this day and for this generation that I live in, and for my classmates, and for the people that I work with, and what a difference it makes for someone to come from the Lord, in reality, to his co-laborers, or to his fellow students, or to the people that he works with, or to his wife, and his children, to his family. To be able to say, as Paul did, that which I have received of the Lord, I have delivered unto you. And here Samuel, I think, in very much the same way, realizes that it's when he prays for God's people, when he's before the Lord on behalf of Israel, that is when God speaks, and that his ministry wouldn't be valid, and the authority that's there wouldn't be there if he wouldn't bow his knee before the throne of God. And he says, God forbid that I should cease to pray for you, but I will teach you the good and the right way. Only fear the Lord and serve him in truth with all of your heart. For consider how great things he hath done for you. But if you shall still do wickedly, you shall be consumed, both you and your king, that you think is going to be the answer to all of your problems. Now, Saul reigned 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years, we just went through a year and a semicolon there. Saul reigned 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, Saul chose him 3,000 men of Israel, whereof 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash and in Mount Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin, and the rest of the people he sent every man to his tent. And Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was at Gibeah, and the Philistines heard of it. And Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, let the Hebrews hear. And all Israel, notice this is hearsay, all Israel heard say that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines. Saul did not smite the garrison of the Philistines. Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines. It wasn't Saul. We're going to see this constant problem with Saul of making excuses, of jealousy, of disobedience. And here we're going to see Saul take the glory for something that he didn't do. He's touching something that wasn't his. It's pride. It's jealousy. We're going to see it again with David when David kills Goliath and the people saying, you know, Saul has slain his thousands, but David has slain his 10,000s. That from that day forward, he hated David. He was envious of David because the people admired what he had accomplished. And here it says that Israel heard that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines, and that Israel also was had an abomination with the Philistines, and the people were called together after Saul to Gilgal. And the Philistines gathered themselves together to fight with Israel. Now, this is one of the largest gathering of the Philistines recorded in the Old Testament. It's almost unimaginable. 30,000 chariots, if you can imagine. 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and people as the sand which is on the seashore in multitude. Now, that's quite a gathering. And they came up and pitched in Michmash, eastward from Beth-Aven, house of vanity. This multitude, imagine 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and an army without number like the sand of the sea. That's important for you to get that impressed on your mind, because the victory that Israel will experience over this multitude will be because of the desire to serve God in the heart of one person. Because we live in times where the odds seem insurmountable against us and what we believe and what we care for. When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were distressed, then the people did hide themselves, here's Saul's army, in caves and in thickets, in rocks, in the high places, and in pits. How wonderful to have a king. They said, give us a king that he might protect us and go out before us with the army. Now they got a king and they're hiding in pits. And some of the Hebrews went over Jordan. They move across the river Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. As for Saul, he was still at Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. Now take note of that, because I believe that we also live in fearful times. I'm troubled as I look what's going on around us. When I see the earthquakes that are happening everywhere, when I see the war, when I see the injustice here, when I see what the legislators are doing, when I see people that can walk into a prayer meeting or into a church and cut down 14-year-olds and 15-year-olds. I'm troubled. We also live in fearful times. Again, one of the things that really encouraged me was Billy Graham's perspective when he was asked, are these the worst times that there have ever been? He said, these are the worst times that there's ever been, and these are the best times that there's ever been. And he said, because the Lord told a parable about a man who went and sowed his field, and an evil worker came and sowed tares among the wheat. And his servants came to the Lord and said, should we go out there and pull up the tares because some evil worker has sown tares among the wheat? And the Lord of the harvest said, no, don't do that lest you uproot the wheat also. Leave them grow together until harvest. And Billy Graham said, we're near the end of the world, so the tares are riper than they have ever been. So things are worse than they've ever been. But the wheat is riper than it's ever been, so things are better than they've ever been. And he said, now we're just waiting for the angels to come and thrust in the sickle. And of course, Larry King changed the subject immediately. But I thought, what an interesting perspective. These are fearful times that we live in. But on the other hand, God made us for this hour. God made us to sit in this church in Philadelphia in this hour of human history. He could have sent us into our spirits into the world in any generation in human history. He made us for this hour. And so I know, like you, me, you know, sometimes we look around and think, I hope he's got it right. No, he made us for this hour. This is when we're supposed to live. This is the ministry we're supposed to have. This is the generation that we're supposed to walk in. And we're going to see, like these insurmountable odds here, God is never troubled because the enemy is too strong. That never happens. God is only troubled because the faith of Israel is not strong enough. God is always troubled because he can't find one man or a dozen men or a dozen women that will stand up. He's never troubled by the strength of the enemy. That isn't anything to him. The earth itself is like dust in the balances before the Lord. He laid out the heavens with the span of his hand. 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and Philistines like the sand of the sea is nothing before God. And Israel's trembling. And I think sometimes that I can let my heart go there as I look at the days that we live in. And he, Saul, tarried 7 days according to the set time that Samuel had appointed. But Samuel came not. Well, the 7 days weren't over. Samuel, back in chapter 10, had told Saul, you go to Gilgal, you wait for me 7 days. I'll be there. No doubt the people are watching for Samuel, because the last time Samuel prayed, remember, he sacrificed a lamb and he prayed. It was earthquakes and the ground was swallowing up Philistines and they were running, and they're looking at all of this huge multitude, this army, and they're hoping Sam is on his way. He tarried there 7 days according to the set time Samuel had appointed, but Samuel came not to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. So as Saul is looking, the deserters are kind of leaving in trickles off into the mountains, hiding in caves and so forth. And Saul said, bring here the burnt offering to me and the peace offerings. And he offered the burnt offering. And it came to pass that as soon as he had made an end of offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him, that he might salute him. And Samuel said, what have you done? And Saul said, now this is amazing. Saul's going to give him 5 excuses. It should have been a prophet or a priest that's offering the sacrifice, not Saul. That's not his prerogative. He's a civil leader, chosen by God, anointed by God, but not a spiritual leader, not a prophet, not a priest. And because in unbelief he sees the people leaving, he calls those together that are still there and he begins to offer the sacrifices. Samuel does come within the time period that he said he would come, and he says to Saul, what is it that you've done? And Saul said, well, listen to these excuses. There's 5 of them. I'll read through first. Saul said, because I saw the people were scattered from me and you came not within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered themselves together at Michmash. Therefore said I, the Philistines will come down now upon me to Gilgal. I have not made supplication unto the Lord, so I forced myself. Therefore, and offered a burnt offering. Listen to these excuses. First of all, he says, it's the people's fault. They were scattered. They didn't stick with me. Some army God's given me. The people were scattered. Secondly, it's the enemy's, it's your fault. You didn't come. That's the second thing he says. And you didn't show up when you were supposed to. Don't blame me. It's the people's fault. It's your fault. Then he says, the Philistines gathers. The devil made me do it. It's the enemy's fault. Then he says, and I haven't made supplication. You know how I hate to go to battle without seeking the Lord. I'm such a spiritual man. I was afraid the battle was going to start before we had sought the Lord. So I forced myself to offer a burnt offering. He becomes a man of excuses. Samuel said to Saul, thou hast done foolishly. It would be the epitaph of his life. Saul would pronounce it upon himself. I have played the fool. I have sinned grievously. I believe that Samuel is eliciting a confession from Saul. Saul could have said, Samuel, pray to God for me. Just forgive me. I lacked faith. I saw the Philistines. I saw the army deserting. I was scared. Fear overcame me. And I know it's wrong. And I was foolish. Pray that God will forgive me. I believe that God, through Samuel, was eliciting that kind of a thing from Saul. But Saul wouldn't give it. And Saul just continually made excuses. You know Christians like this. They compromise. They live in sin. All that God wants from them when they're challenged and faced with their transgression, with their sin, is he wants a confession. He, like the prodigal, God just wants them to come back and say, Father, I've sinned before heaven and before you. And they continually make these excuses. They continually rationalize. They continually blame someone else. Samuel said to Saul, thou hast done foolishly. Thou hast not kept the commandment of the Lord thy God, which he commanded thee. For now would the Lord have established thy kingdom upon Israel forever. Saul, God was looking to bless, not looking to destroy, not looking to let the Philistines kill you. God was seeking your blessing. But now, thy kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought him a man after his own heart, and the Lord hath commanded him to be captain over his people, because thou hast not kept that which the Lord commanded thee. He says there's already someone else. And David must be awfully young by this point in time. But he's saying, even as a boy, David's 16 or 17 when Samuel anoints him. So this is a while before that. What is David at this point in time? We're not sure. 13, 14, 15. Is he in junior high ministry with Gil? You know, the interesting thing is God can minister to the heart of a junior higher. And God is saying, I've already found someone, a man after my own heart. What that means is that this is a man who is in step with the will of God. He's after God's heart in the sense that he's in harmony with the burden in the heart of God. He's given his life to the things that God lays out in front of him and says, this is my heart. This is my heart towards the people. This is my heart toward the church. This is my heart towards sin. This is my heart towards repentance. This is my heart towards my word, towards the Holy Spirit. This is a young man, and I pray that there's lots of Davids gals, I hope you're Davids too. Because God can notice when you're 13, when you're 16, when you're 20, when you're 30, when you're 50, that there's a heart that's beating in time with his own heart. It's looking at Philadelphia, or the school that you go to, or the place that you work, and he knows when he sees a heart that's throbbing in time with his own. And he said, Saul, I'd have blessed, I'd have given you the kingdom. But you have your own will. You're so stubborn. You're doing things your own way. You're making excuses. But I have found someone whose heart is beating in time with mine. And Saul will rebel against this. He's just telling Saul here, I'd have established your throne. Now your son Jonathan, your grandson's not going to sit on the throne. That's going to end. But Saul could have still lived out his life on the throne. It's going to come in chapter 15 where finally Samuel's going to have to say, now God has taken the throne away from you. But at this point, still there's grace. He could have lived out his own life and served the Lord as king of Israel. He says, your throne won't be established in your family because you haven't kept the commandment of the Lord. And Samuel arose and gat him up from Gilgal unto Gibeah of Benjamin. And Saul numbered the people that were present with him about 600 men. Now that's down from 3,000. So 2,400 guys have deserted. And he's got 600 men. And Saul and Jonathan his son and the people that were present with them abode in Gibeah of Benjamin. But the Philistines had camped at Michmash. And the spoilers, they sent out raiding parties, because when you have men like the sand of the sea, you need victuals. So they sent out raiding parties. The spoilers came out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned unto the way that leadeth unto Ophrah, unto the land of Shual. Another company turned by the way of Beth-horon. Another company turned by the way of the border that looketh toward the valley of Zeboam, toward the wilderness. Now there was no smith found throughout, that's a blacksmith, found throughout all of the land of Israel. For the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make themselves swords and spears. Now the archaeologist Spade has proved this out, that the Philistines were much stronger in metallurgy, working with bronze and with iron and so forth. And the Israelites were dependent on them, even to have their axes and their plows sharpened and to buy swords. They would have to go to the Philistines. But all the Israelites went down to the Philistines to sharpen every man his share, his coulter, his axe, and his mattock. Yet they had a file for the mattocks and for the coulters and for the forks and for the axes to sharpen the goads. So some of the Israelites at least had a file. So it came to pass in the day of battle that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people that were with Saul and Jonathan. Notice, but with Saul and with Jonathan his son there was found. So there were two swords in the army of Israel. Here's the army of Israel. They got pitchforks, hammers, whatever they got. Two swords. Saul's got one and Jonathan's got one. We're facing 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and soldiers with swords like the sand of the sea. What do we got? Two swords. It's like those commercials they show at the football games in black and white, you know. Do we have a computer? Have this? Well, I got a pencil. I like that. Let's go on, you know. Here's two swords in Israel. Now, it came to pass upon a day. Great, great story. Came to pass upon a day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said unto the young man that bare his armor, come, let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side. But he told not his father. Now, that's because his dad wouldn't have had an inkling of what he was doing. We're going to, you know, the more we look at Jonathan, the more remarkable this young man is. We see why he loved David as his own soul, because he had a heart like David. There was no Goliath that he was not afraid to, he wasn't afraid to face any Goliath, Jonathan. We're going to see that he's so much like David. So he goes over against the garrison of the Philistines, one sword and his armor bearer. Didn't tell his dad. Dad wouldn't have understood anyway. Dad didn't have the heart that Jonathan did. And Saul tarried in the uttermost part of Gibeah under the pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. And the people that were with him were about 600 men. And Ahiah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, was wearing the ephod. And the people knew not that Jonathan was gone. Because Jonathan's got something cooking between him and the Lord. He doesn't have to let people know. Jesus warned that hypocrites like that. They like to pray in front of people. They like to fast in front of people. They like to give alms in front of people. And Jesus said, when you do those things, do them in secret, because your Father who sees in secret, he'll reward you openly. He sees those things. And Jonathan has a real enough relationship with the Lord where he doesn't need the army. He just says to his armor bearer, you know, come on, let's go over there and take a look at these Philistines. And between the passages by which Jonathan sought to go over under the Philistines' garrison, there was a sharp rock on the one side and a sharp rock on the other side. The name of the one was Bozez, and the name of the other was Shenna. The forefront of the one was situated northward over against Michmash, and the other southward against Gibeah. And those stones are there today. The Israeli guides sometimes will take you there, and these two huge outcroppings that are pointed are still there today. And it's a steep hill that goes up between them. And Jonathan said unto the young man that bare his armor. Evidently now they're looking and seeing the Philistines there, a garrison that's close to this place. Come, let us go over unto the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us. For there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few. What an amazing place to camp. You just want to camp right here for a while. Jonathan says, let's go over to these uncircumcised Philistines. What he's saying is, they're outside the covenant. Their lives are not consecrated to God. They're uncircumcised. You know, David will say the same thing as he comes to the battlefield and watch the champion of the Philistines, Goliath, come out every day and challenge the armies of Israel. David will say the very same thing. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he comes to challenge the armies of the living God? And Jonathan has the same heart. Let's go let's go see what these uncircumcised Philistines are doing in our life. They're outside the covenant. We are inside the covenant. We have a covenant with our God. And we have a better covenant. We have a covenant with our God. The New Testament says the evil one comes, he touches us not. That we're sealed with the Holy Spirit. That we don't have to walk around and be afraid, the enemy. No. We're the ones who are inside the covenant. It's our dad who's on the throne, who runs the universe, who loves us more than we love our kids. And who knows what God might do? Let's go see. Who knows what God might do with someone whose heart is given over to him? Who knows what he might do in our family, or where we work, or in our school, or in our neighborhood, or in our church? Who knows what God might do? Who knows what wonderful thing he might do if he can get a hold of someone? If there's a man or a woman whose heart could be wholly given over. Moody, challenged by that very idea, the world has yet to see what God can do with a man or a woman whose heart is completely given over to him. And this wonderful thing here, let's go over. These uncircumcised, what do they think? This is the land that God gave to the children of Israel. It's our God who parted the Red Sea. It's our God who destroyed Israel. It's our God who gave us victory. It's our God who stopped the Jordan River. We're inside of that covenant. Let's see what God might do. And I'm sure that God's looking down from heaven going like this. All right. I got one. Because God is never restrained by natural difficulty. And every Philistine in our life, and every thousand Philistines in our life, whatever they might be, are an opportunity for the glory of God. And God is never restrained or staggered by the odds. The enemy is never too big. He's looking for a Jonathan. He's looking for a David. He's looking for a heart that's perfect towards him, that he might show himself strong on their behalf. In fact, his eyes are going to and fro throughout the earth looking for those hearts. His armor bearer said unto him, verse 7, and this has to be a great guy too. I think he's infected from hanging around Jonathan. Do all that's in thine heart. Turn thee. Behold, I'm with you according to your heart. Hey, whatever you got cooking, I'm with you. Great guy. Then said Jonathan, listen to this rationale, please. Then said Jonathan, behold, we're going to pass over unto these men, and we're going to reveal ourselves to them. If they say to us, tarry until we come to you, then we'll stand still in our place and will not go up to them. But if they say to us, come up unto us, then we will go up, for the Lord has delivered them into our hand. And this shall be the sign unto us. And both of them revealed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. So here's Jonathan's rationale. He says to his armor bearer, let's do this. Here they are. He's got an armor bearer carrying his armor and one sword. The garrison of the Philistines. Let's do this. We'll go up there and we'll jump out from behind a rock and we'll go na 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 and we'll reveal ourselves to the Philistines. If the Philistines say to us, stay right there, we'll be down in a minute, we won't move, we'll stand our ground. But if the Philistines say to us, come on up here, we'll teach you a lesson, then we know God's delivered the Philistine army into our hands and we'll go kill them. That would give me a lot of security. Good idea, Jonathan. You go first. I mean, just listen to that. You see, the beauty of it is this guy's got something cooking in his heart. What we do is we get caught in the paralysis of analysis. We look at a difficult situation, we'll line to this, and they have this many swords and this, and if we'd have to do this, we'd have to line them up, we could get them one at a time, we should go at night, we'll get night goggles, the Philistines don't have them, they're not that sophisticated, and if we have night vision, we can go in, you know, and we kind of analyze everything, and we analyze it to the point where we get paralyzed, and we don't do anything for God. And God's looking, you know, isn't it interesting? I was reading Watchman Nee the other day, and he was talking about Saul. And it says Saul was head and shoulders above everyone in Israel. And Watchman Nee said, you know, that's the problem. So often, it's someone's head who gets in the way of what God wants to do. God's looking for a heart, and here's a head all the time sticking above the crowd. Well, I think this, and I think that, and logically this is not going to work, and how are we going to do this? You know, Jesus saying to Peter, Peter, come out of the boat and walk on the water. Lord, you don't understand the law of gravity. Human beings cannot walk on water. Now, I would love to play along, Lord, with your plan here, but if human beings step on water, they sink. I'm glad that Peter's the kind of guy that actually said, what was he thinking? Lord, if that's you, and this is crazier than Jonathan, bid me to come to you on the water. Now, first of all, Lord, if that's you, who else does he know who walks around on the water in a storm? If that's you, that's the most ridiculous part of the question. Jonathan says, let's do this to his armor bearer. We'll jump out, reveal ourselves. If they say, we're coming to get you guys, then we'll just stay put. If they say, hey, come on up here, we're going to teach you a lesson, then we know God's delivered them into our hands and we'll go get them. God's looking for guys like this, I'll tell you that, that are willing to step out, find out what God might do. Verse 11 says, so both of them revealed themselves, discovered themselves unto the garrison of the Philistines, and the Philistines said, behold, look, the Hebrews have come forth out of the holes where they hid themselves. They make fun of them. Oh, look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes. And the men of the garrison answered Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us and we'll show you a thing or two. That's what it implies. And Jonathan said unto his armor bearer, great, this is it. Let's go get them. Come up after me, for the Lord has delivered them into the hand of Israel. Excuse me, Jonathan, we're not Israel. We're two guys, one sword, 30,000 chariots, 6,000, you know, cavalry, Philistines like the sand of the sea. So Jonathan climbed up. It has to be uphill, too, on top of everything else. Jonathan climbed up upon his hands and upon his feet, and his armor bearer after him, and they fell before Jonathan and his armor bearer. He slew after him. So Jonathan's knocking him down, stabbing him down, and whatever his armor bearer has, he's getting him right behind Jonathan. And that first slaughter, which Jonathan and his armor bearer made, was about 20 men within, as it were, a half acre of land, which is a yoke of oxen might plow. Just so imagine half the sanctuary. Half an acre. This is not, we killed 20 guys, one every mile. We snuck up on them and fought with them. This is 20 guys and a half an acre. One guy with a sword. Imagine being on this half of the sanctuary, pull out the pews, one guy with a sword against 20 guys with a sword. I don't like those odds. But this is the Lord's battle. This is not according, this is not, you know, Zorro. This is not Jonathan's swordsmanship that does this. This is the living God. 20 Philistines are down and dead, and a half an acre. One guy and his armor bearer. And there was trembling in the host, in the field, among all the people, the garrison and the spoilers. They also trembled. And the earth quaked. That always helps. The earth began to tremble, so it was a very great trembling. The Hebrew says it was a trembling of God. God began to shake. Shake and bake, you know. He reaches down and just starts to shake the Philistine army. First of all, they're going, what's going on? You know, there's those two guys. 20 guys are dead. And then the ground starts to shake. The whole army of the Philistines is shaken. And the watchmen of Saul in Gibeah and Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude of the Philistines melted away. And they went on beating down one another. They're killing one another, trying to get out of there. Thousands of them without number. One guy. And his God. You and God are always a majority. Doesn't matter how many thousand of them there are. Saul, and he's with the 600 men, look up and see the Philistines. They're running, they're trampling each other, they're killing each other, they're melting away. And he's thinking, what in the world is going on now? Then said Saul unto the people that were with him, number now and see who is gone from us. And when they had numbered, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. And Saul said unto Abiah, bring here the ark of God. For the ark of God was at that time with the children of Israel. So here's Saul right away. This is the paralysis of analysis. He's figuring out what he's got to do here. And it came to pass while Saul talked with the priest that the noise that was in the host of the Philistines went on and increased, became so loud that Saul said unto the priest, just forget it, withdraw thy hand, forget it, forget the ark. And Saul said to all the people that were with him, assemble themselves, and they came to the battle. Behold, every man's sword was against his fellow of the Philistines, and they were in very great discomfiture. I like that, when God puts the enemies in very great discomfiture. They were discomfited. Moreover, the Hebrews that were with the Philistines before that time, who had become allies with them, which went up with them into the camp from the country round about, even they also turned to be with the Israelites that were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, all the men of Israel that had hid themselves in Mount Ephraim, when they heard that the Philistines fled, even they also followed hard after them in the battle. So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle passed over unto Beth-Aven. One guy. One guy. We live in fearful times. People are trembling. What might the Lord do if he gets a hold of one complete life? Because, you know, I believe faith is contagious. It's interesting because it tells us this back in Deuteronomy, when God is describing the laws of warfare, he says, the officers shall speak further unto the people, and they shall say, what man is there that is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return unto his house, lest his brethren's heart faint as well as his heart. God knows that unbelief is contagious. And God says, when I'm taking the children of Israel into battle, and he describes the ark's going to go before, I'm going to destroy your enemies. And he said, if you got a bunch of guys in the Israelite army that are standing around going, he said, send them home. Because that's infectious. They're going to freak everybody else out. Well, on the other side of the coin is true. How many times as we study through the scripture are we seeing the life of one man or one woman that stands in the presence of the living God instead of in the presence of the Philistines and says, Lord, who knows what you might do? Who knows what might happen, Lord? Jonathan's faith thousands of Philistines fleeing Israel. Great victory. And the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul, here's why, had adjured the people, saying, "Cursed be the man that eateth any food until evening, that I may be avenged on my enemies." Wrong, Saul. They're not your enemies. They're God's enemies. And you're not being avenged. God's being avenged. So none of the people tasted any food. Saul makes this stupid commandment. He's seeing victory. He likes to get his hands on it right away. He says, nobody's allowed to eat. Keep pursuing the Philistines, because they fought till sundown. He says, chase them. Don't stop to eat. Don't anybody stop. And there's going to be a curse on anybody who eats today. We just want to stay in the battle pursuit. And it's typical of church history. Whenever there's a movement of God, somebody wants to make rules and traditions. Somebody wants to get their hands on it. This was not the will of God. There was a great move of God here. If the people would have, as they're running through the Philistine camp, stopped and grabbed a piece of bread or something, they'd have had strength and they've completely defeated the Philistines. We're going to find out by the end of the day that they're fainting. They're without strength because Saul opened his mouth and made this stupid commandment. How often people are just afraid to let God move without getting their hands all over it. And all they of the land came to the forest, to the wood. There was honey upon the ground. And when the people were come into the forest, behold, honey was dripping around them. You can see them, I'm not allowed to eat. Any other time you go in the forest, there's not honey dripping around, just when you're not allowed to have it. But no man put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. But Jonathan heard not when his father charged the people with the oath. Wherefore, he put forth the end of the rod that was in his hand, dipped it in a honeycomb, and put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes were enlightened. He was refreshed. He was strengthened because he took time here. And I'm sure that Jonathan is thinking, Lord, you told Israel of old you would drive out their enemies from before them, that this is a land that flows with milk and with honey, and that you would give this land to us by faith. He must have been tasting that honey thinking, Lord, you're sweeter. Your name, you're sweeter than this, Lord. Then answered one of the people and said, you know, your dad straightly charged the people with an oath, saying, cursed be the man that eateth any food this day, and the people are faint. Then said Jonathan, my father hath troubled the land. See, I pray you, how my eyes have been enlightened. Look, I'm refreshed because I tasted a little bit of this honey. How much more if perhaps the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found, for had there not been now a much greater slaughter amongst the Philistines, we might have had complete victory if my father hadn't said this. And they smote the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ajalon, and the people were very faint. And the people flew upon the spoil as the sun goes down, and they took sheep and oxen and calves and slew them on the ground, and the people did eat them with the blood. They didn't drain them properly, which was Levitical law. They're keeping the law of Saul, which is a foolish vow, but they're breaking the law of God, which is a greater sin, and this is all caused by Saul. Then they told Saul, saying, behold, the people sin against the Lord in that they eat with the blood. They're not properly draining the animals. And he said, you have transgressed. Boy, this guy's got nerve. Roll a great stone unto me this day. And Saul said, disperse yourselves among the people, and say unto them, bring me here every man his ox, every man his sheep, and slay them here and eat, and sin not against the Lord in eating with the blood. So this is typical of someone who lives in compromise and sin, who is always worried about somebody else sinning. You know people like that? Beam men. They got a beam in their eye, but they want to take a splinter out of yours, and they're knocking your head off all the time. Here he's worried about the sin of the people. All the people brought every man his ox with them that night and slew them there. And Saul built an altar unto the Lord. The same was the first altar that he built unto the Lord. And we aren't told that he had any unction from God to build an altar. And Saul said, let us go down after the Philistines by night and spoil them until the morning light. Let us not leave one man of them. And they said, do whatever seems good unto you. Then said the priest, well, let us draw near unto God. Let's get some direction here. And Saul asked counsel of God, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Wilt thou deliver them into the hand of Israel?" But he answered him not that day. Now, immediately, the king, the priests are wondering, there must be sin in the camp. God is not answering. He's just granted a tremendous victory, and yet he's not speaking to us. And Saul said, "Draw ye near hither all the chief of the people, and know and see wherein this sin hath been this day." God isn't answering. Something's wrong. "For as the Lord liveth, which saved Israel, though it be in Jonathan my son," here he goes saying another stupid vow, "he shall surely die." He has no idea. "But there was not a man among all the people that answered him," because all of them are standing there going, "Oy vey, you know, this guy doesn't know," because they knew it was Jonathan. "Then said he unto all Israel, Be ye on one side, and I and Jonathan my son, we will be on the other side. And the people said unto Saul, Well, do whatever seems good to you." That's what they keep saying to their king now. "Therefore Saul said unto the Lord God of Israel, Give a perfect lot." Lord, we're going to cast lots. Show us what's going on. "And Saul and Jonathan were taken, but the people escaped." So as they're casting lots, it's getting narrowed down. Finally, only Saul and Jonathan are left. And Saul said, "Well, cast lots between me and Jonathan, my son." And Jonathan was taken. And Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what thou hast done." Well, what Jonathan had done was put the entire army of the Philistines to flight by trusting God. That's what he did. His sin was taking some honey and putting it in his mouth. And Jonathan told him and said, "I did but taste a little bit of honey with the end of my rod that was in my hand, and lo, I must die." And Saul answered, "God do so and more also, for thou shalt surely die, Jonathan." Thanks, Dad. You know, Saul, we can see here, is losing his senses. You know, Saul, again, doesn't say, "God, forgive me. You've used my son to grant this great victory. He had more faith than I did." No, Saul now is more worried about his own stupid rule he made about eating than he is about the truth. You know, when I was thinking about that, I used to grow up, you know, my parents, we ate fish every Friday. We never ate meat. And I think because, for years, I hated fish because of that. I love fish now because I don't have to eat it. But I think, and then I got saved and I thought, where is this in the Bible? I can't find it. That you can't eat meat on Friday. And almost some rule, some foolishness. I remember running into my aunt once at the mall on Good Friday. I guess, which is, you know, really not a meat day. And I was in the middle of this big hot dog. And I didn't expect to see her there, and she stopped dead in her tracks, and her mouth fell open. And I said, "What? What's wrong?" She said, "You're eating meat on Friday, on Good Friday." I think it was a second or third hot dog, too. I was in there. And I thought, "Lord, thank you for delivering me." Saul, "God do so more and also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan." Not "God forgive me, what tremendous victory you've granted. Oh Lord, I'm so foolish to open my mouth to make these rules." No, his own pride is there and Jonathan is going to die. And the people said unto Saul, "Shall Jonathan die who hath wrought this great salvation in Israel? God forbid, as the Lord liveth, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he hath wrought with God this day." So the people rescued Jonathan that he died not from their king that they wanted so desperately. Then Saul went up from following the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place, what was left of them. And we have this brief kind of picture of Saul's reign to the end of the chapter. Saul took the kingdom over Israel, fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the children of Ammon, against Edom, against the kings of Zeboah, and against the Philistines. Whithersoever he turned himself, he vexed them. And he gathered a host and smote the Amalekites and delivered Israel out of the hands of them that spoiled them. So God is still with him in these things. God so gracious. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan, Ishua, and Melchishua. Who would name your kids Ishua and Melchishua? I think you'd have enough with one. And the names of his two daughters were these. The name of the firstborn was Merab, and the name of the second was Michael. We'll meet her. And the name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam. And he calls her, he calls his son Jonathan, the son of a perverse, wretched woman. We don't know much about Ahinoam besides his commentary. The daughter of Ahimaatz. And the name of the captain of his host was Abner, the son of Ner. So Abba is father. So this guy Ner has a son and names his son, my father is Ner. That'd be like, you know, me having a son and naming my son, my dad is Joe. Isn't that funny? Abner, the son of Ner, was Saul's uncle. And Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. And there was sore war against the Philistines all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he took him unto himself. So we see this man, Saul, continually gathering the flesh, continually gathering, you know, by his own analysis, those who seem fit for battle. It's interesting because in the beginning of the book of Judges, chapter 3, it tells us that God left some of the enemies, Israel in the land, because it was a generation that needed to learn how to do battle. And when you look at Joshua coming into the land, you know, you have the Jordan River standing still and dividing. You have the sun stand still in the Valley of Ajalon. You have tremendous supernatural victories not because Joshua and his army practiced swordsmanship or practiced archery, because they got on their knees and they sought the living God, and God would give them the battle plan. And it says in the beginning of Judges, when that generation faded away and a new generation came who knew not the wars of the Lord, that God left a number of the enemy in the land so that they would learn to do battle. And now here is Jonathan as a throwback to that. He's a man like Joshua. He's a man who understands it isn't anything to do with my natural ability. It's God. It's supernatural. Says to his armor bearer, let's go. Let's see. Who knows what God might do? Who knows what God might do? Yeah, these are fearful times. Yeah, kids are getting shot in a church in Fort Worth. Yeah, our society's crumbling. But who knows what God might do with one young man, one young woman who says, Lord, here I am. I'm imperfect. I'm a sinner saved by grace. But here's my life, and here's my heart. Here's my will. I surrender to you. And who knows what the Lord might do. You know, I look at everything that's going on in the world, and I know in my heart, God is not restricted in the least. In fact, He loves the Red Sea thing. He loves the armies of the Egyptian barking up our heels and an impossibility in front of us, so that when He does something, there's no mistake of who's doing it.